Good evening and welcome. My name is Rabbi Jeff Sachs. I'm the director of Atid and its Web Yeshiva program. But for our purposes tonight, I suppose my notoriety comes from being the editor of the volume we're discussing, To Mourn a Child, Jewish Responses to Neonatal and Childhood Death. I should say that I'm the co-editor, and I want to thank in absentia my co-editor, Dr. Joel B. Walowalski in New York, who, like so many things and so many interesting publishing projects and work in Jewish education, was a force behind the book, and I thank him as well as the folks at the OU Press, particularly Mr. Simon Posner in New York, who were involved in publishing the work. This week, when we read on Shabbat, Vayidom Aaron, the deafening silence of Aaron HaKohen in the face of unspeakable mourning, we're reminded that despite our best efforts to give voice to the inner feelings, and most of the book are the collections of personal reflections, principally by parents, although by other people as well, siblings, grandparents, other people in the larger community, people that bring a therapeutic point of view, rabbis and others, but principally the book is a collection of reflections by parents on the experience of losing a child, either neonatal death, death of older children, the whole array of things. There's a story. I had thought of putting it into the preface to the book where I tell some of my own story and how I became involved with this project. Like, I presume many of you, I too am a member of the unenviable society of the Mishpachot HaShchol, that interesting phenomena that Biblical Hebrew has a specific term for the avelut, for the mourning that families that lose children. It's categorically different. It can't be lumped together with all other types of mourning. And there's a specific word that's used only for parents who suffer the loss of children. And I too, like I said, I presume, like many of you, are a member of this unenviable society. And I tell some of that story in the preface to the book, and I won't recount it here. But there's a story that I left out. It's an apocryphal story. It probably didn't actually happen, but that doesn't matter. That's never prevented Jewish storytellers from telling a good story. And the story goes that sometime in the 20s or 30s, Ernest Hemingway and a group of his writer cronies are sitting around a table in the Algonquin Club in New York, drinking hard and talking about the craft of writing. And Hemingway makes a bet that he could write a whole novel in merely 6 words. And they all put money into the pot, and then he takes a napkin and he scribbles, "For sale, baby shoes, never worn." And he collected the bet. The profundity of each and every story, of each and every loss of a child, could fill many volumes much fatter than our slim volume. And as many voices as we were able to include, there are just as many that we weren't able to include. There are all types of perspectives that had to be left out, either because we had trouble finding somebody that was prepared to write about it. I thought it would have been important to have parents writing about suicide of a child. But you can imagine that was hard to commission an essay on. We deliberately left out victims of terror or children who were killed here in Sahel, in the army, figuring that those are unique experiences in a different way and probably deserve a collection and a book unto their own. But of course, in some ways, those voices would be appropriate and would have a place in this collection as well. Tonight, what you're going to hear are a sampling of some of those voices by a sampling of some of the authors in the book. And the evening will be moderated by my good friend, Rabbi David Fine, and I wanted to thank him for really undertaking the organization and the initiative to make this whole evening happen, and it's being done under the canopy of his important and new Barkai Institution, the Barkai Institute for Practical Rabbinics, and I think that's very appropriate, because an organization such as his, which has taken on the work of trying to train young rabbis to work here in Israeli synagogues and communities, and the importance of trying to put sensitivities to issues such as the one we're describing today, an issue which is so difficult and so complex, and so each story again stands alone in such a stark way that sometimes we as friends, we as neighbors, we as relatives, and even we as educators and rabbis don't always know how to be appropriate responders. And this is just one example of the important things that Barkai has taken on. And I think that, I mean, I'll give you a plug, that there's more information about your important work, David, on these flyers that are here. And then just finally, thanks to our friends at Ktav/Urim, who are selling the book here at a discounted price, along with their other fine Jewish literature. So thank you all for coming tonight. I'm sure we have an interesting conversation ahead.
Thank you. Thank you to Rabbi Sachs. I want to thank my very close friend Jeff for getting me involved in this project. I think that it was in some ways a real life-changing experience for me, and I'll talk about that in a little while. I also want to thank Dr. Joel Wawalski. He was actually my math teacher in high school. Interestingly enough, I don't think I would be standing here today if it were not for him, because my parents didn't want to let me go to Israel the year after high school. They didn't want me to go to yeshiva. I sort of grew up in a conservadox world, and they had some idea that everyone that went to Israel got brainwashed and came back, you know, rejecting the lifestyle that they had lived up till then. And he actually convinced my parents. What? And actually, it was Joel that convinced my parents to let me go to Israel for the year. So, by trade, he's a math teacher, but he did actually teach a class in Flatbush when we were seniors. On it was called Death and Dying, and so this topic has interested him for many years. We won't go into why. I think it was very important for high school students to start dealing with some of these issues on a at a very young age. So I want to thank everyone for coming. And I want to just start by, I think that in a moment everyone will, all the panelists will introduce themselves and tell a little bit of their stories, although the full essays are in the book. I want to just start by telling a little bit of my experience in terms of writing this essay. When Jeff called me and asked me if I would participate in this, I was like, I don't know what I would write. I mean, I had never really processed this whole experience that I had when I was 3 years old, when my brother passed away. Very different from some of the experiences as that you'll hear from parents. And so I agreed, but I said, look, I don't know if I could do this. I didn't know what I would write. So I sat in front of my computer, as I often do. Usually it just takes a few hours, and eventually I get some inspiration, and I write quite a bit. And I just couldn't get anything down on the computer. So I figured I'd try to do it the old-fashioned way, and I took some paper and a pen, remember those? And I went into a cafe in Modi'in, near where I live, and I literally stared at the paper for an hour or two, and then in some kind of mystical way, I all of a sudden just started writing, and 2 hours later, I was still writing, and it was really a cathartic experience for me, and it was life-changing, because I realized that I had never actually process this whole experience that I had had. I thought for much of my life, although I thought about it a lot, I thought that I, you know, I was a small child, and it didn't really affect me. And in many ways, over the last few years since we wrote the book, I've really, in many ways, it's been life changing for me. So with that small introduction, before we get into the meat of the topic, I want to just ask our panelists first to just introduce themselves very briefly. You know, names and serial numbers and where you come from. And I want to ask you, because, you know, for me, this was a very, very long time ago. It was 42 years ago, almost 43 years ago. And for many of you, it was much more recent. So I was just wondering whether you had a similar experience or not, whether you felt it was cathartic for the people, you know, who had some of these experiences, whether you felt that way in writing the articles yourself. So why don't you start, Dasi? Oh, why don't you take the mic?
I'm Dasi Jacobson. I'm part of a couple here with Dan. Dan and I, we lost our daughter Eliana almost 14 years ago, and she was 2 years old. We decided that I would say where I was and Dan would say where he is, because we're supposed to just give a very brief synopsis of what happened. Okay, so first of all, we live in Gush Etzion, and we're both psychologists. Is that our name, rank, and serial number? So 14 years ago in June, almost 14 years ago, I was at home. It was early in the morning, and I was about to leave the house. And our older daughter, who was four, and Eliana, who was our two-year-old daughter, were both kind of before the school day. I think it was the second to last day of school. And I was preparing to leave, and our babysitter was with me. And Eliana was in the kitchen, and she was eating breakfast, and she had a bowl of fruit, and she was eating grapes, and she choked on a grape. And I was there. I was in the room with her. Our older daughter, Tili, who was four at the time, she was there as well. She wasn't in the room. She was in the adjacent room playing some Sesame Street game or something like that on the computer. And right away, I realized that Eliana was not properly chewing and swallowing the grape because she turned blue. And I called 911, and I was also able to open her airway because she wasn't breathing. And then very quickly, EMS services came. We lived in New York at the time. And they began to work on her. Our babysitter took Tili out of the house across the street to a neighbor who had a friend her age. But she did also see Eliana not breathing and blue, and that is very much part of our story as well. And then the EMS was able to intubate her, and they took her to the hospital. Dan was not at home, and he'll talk about that. And I went in the ambulance with her to the hospital, and very shortly after we got to the hospital, at first they said she was intubated, she was breathing, and that they were going to transfer her to a children's hospital. But then just a few minutes later, she passed away. So that's our story.
I first just want to echo the thank yous that were said before. I think for many of us, having this book years ago would have been helpful, and I hope that many people are able to read it and receive it, and read it in whatever time works for them when these things later happen. That morning, I was in Smicha in NYU at the time. I was learning in one of the new Batei Midrash. It was very summer session, summer's nine. Things were a little bit more relaxed. Shacharis had just finished. And I don't remember what the topic was, but there was something I was working on. And I was very excited after Shacharis because both Rav Schechter, and Rav Willig, whose son is here, another Rav Willig. Rav Willig Sr. was, we're both at Minyan, and we're standing next to each other. And I grabbed the opportunity and wanted to talk to both of them at the same time about the question that I had. While I was engaged in discussion with Rav Willig and Rav Schechter, my cell phone rang in my pocket. I, of course, didn't answer it. It rang a second time and a third time, which was a little strange, but I was with Rav Willig and Rav Schechter, Rosh Hashiva in NYU, and I wasn't going to answer my cell phone when I was in the middle of talking with them. It was a little more concerning when someone came into the assembly looking for me. Dasi had gotten a hold of the secretary in the high school office who came running in to find me. Just to kind of finish off the introductory piece, which then will lead into more of my journey later on, Dasi told me, come immediately, don't drive, get someone to drive you. I went running down the street, saw friends of ours who later became neighbors who were on their way somewhere, asked them if they were available, didn't explain anything to them about why I was asking if they were available. They were on their way to their kids' kindergarten graduation, and I then drove myself 45 minutes to the hospital, Baruch Hashem, and somehow made it in one piece. The ride was a long tefillah bargaining discussion with the Kaddish Baruch Hu. At the time, the call I got from Dasi was that they were in the hospital, that Eliana was alive but being worked on in the hospital. That conversation accidentally recorded on Dasi's cell phone, voicemail. And then that was the end of the intense experience that I had, and it just shut off, and the rest could be continued.
Okay. I thought we were supposed to keep that short. I'm Yehudit Rothschild. My husband is a rabbi, and we lived for 3 years in Perth, Australia, and then 5 years in Miami, Florida, and we've been living in Ephrat for the last 5 years. And our story happened just before we moved to Perth, Australia. I was very young at the time, I was just 21, and we were expecting our first baby, and my husband, who's 13 years older than me, he was 34, and you know, for him, he had waited a long time to get married and a long time for this baby as well, so we're coming from different perspectives, but both very excited. I was way overdue. I was huge and 41 and a half weeks pregnant, and the doctor said, come in and be induced. And this was just a few days after 9/11, by the way. It was in 2001 in September, and it was actually my father's birthday. And well, Saturday night I went to be induced. I went to labor that night. And the next day, the 23rd, was my father's birthday, and everything was going normally. And then it came time to push, and I tried pushing for an hour and a half, and nothing was happening. But still, nothing like really out of the ordinary. And then at one point, the doctor said, you know, we're going to do a C-section. And I said, fine, you know, no problem. It was a little strange. Sometime after she said that, and I got into the operating room, I panicked, and I was in a lot of pain. This is not in the book. And it didn't make any sense. The anesthesiologist was there and said, this makes no sense. You have the same epidural you had all along, but afterwards, I heard from another doctor that sometimes patients can sense things happening. They might feel pain, even though there's no rational explanation for it. So I was in a lot of pain, screaming, get me to the operating room, get me to the operating room, even though I've been calm the entire labor. And my doctor was like, relax. This is a normal procedure. They wheeled me in, and sometime in that time, when I was off the monitor, something happened, and right before the doctor went to make the incision, she listened for the heartbeat, and she said it was either very faint or not there. They didn't say anything to me, but I could tell, even though I couldn't feel anything, I could tell that they were tugging, and I could tell the baby was out and wasn't crying. And I said to my husband, the baby's out and not crying, something's wrong. And he said, no, because we had a C-section. there's a sheet, you can't see anything. He said, no, the baby's not out yet. And I said, no, the baby's out. And he, when he looked, he saw doctors crowded around what he knew was our newborn, and that something was obviously very, very wrong. At that point, you know, the nurse told me to pray. My husband left the room, and, you know, just my story really kind of ends there. The baby didn't make it. The rest of my story, which is in the book, kind of starts with my healing, how I went from just trying to shut everything out to really opening up and embracing it, and that's where my story continues in the book. But that's what happened to us. The baby came out, no cord around the neck, no rational explanation. We did every testing in the world. We don't qualify for any kind of genetic disorder or disease. There was just no, except the baby was in distress, there was really no answers and no guarantee that it would ever happen again. Thank God we have four healthy children now. But did you want us also to address that question about how it felt to write the story? What I wanted to say is that at the time, you asked if it was cathartic.
Right.
At the time, I wrote all this down, and that was cathartic. That was getting out of my system, putting on paper, making sense of it all. I wrote part of it here, we came on a healing trip. But what I did with this book, I think was very different many years later, and a different person. To me, it was empowering rather than cathartic. It wasn't so much therapeutic as much as come from a place of empowerment and feeling like when something like this happens to you, you think, why me? And you're the victim, and you know, why did God choose me out of all these people when all these other people, perfectly normal, and some of my friends and I who went through this, also a joke, some complete idiots are able to have babies. I'm like, why is it us that we couldn't seem to do this right? The empowerment is feeling like now, like it's part of my story, and it doesn't make me a victim. But I felt with writing this, maybe it's just someone was able to give and to contribute something.
My name is Ben Korn. I'm a physician. It's an honor to be here. First of all, my story, in terms of preamble, is exactly like yours. I'm a disciple of Joel Walowski. I was in math class in Chicago. I came to Israel because of
it. You're looking for a different self-help.
Can use that. My story is not as dramatic as the ones that we've heard so far. I feel like I'm really sitting here next to heroic figures. I read this book from cover to cover, and I found that the two chapters that you folks authored to be among the most moving, and I found that I learned a lot from your insights.
You learn a lot from mine?
I like the yellow fire engine business. I'm just sitting here and I'm listening to your point, and it really reminds me of the concept of, you know, that we go back to the Parashat Torah every year, and you know, it's the same Abraham, it's the same Moshe, and yet we're different, and we see things so much differently because of that, and it's so valuable. In my day job, I treat cancer patients. I'm an oncologist in Tel Aviv, a radiation oncologist at Echilov, and I predominantly treat the kinds of tumors that really give cancer a bad name, specifically brain tumors and tumors in the spinal cord. The tumors that are just the most debilitating because they really they really just take away what I think is arguably our most important organ, the brain and the mind. And it's very decimating to see anyone go through that, and to see a young person go through it with a parent. I have many stories to tell. The one that I elected to discuss in this book was a young woman who had a Midas touch. Everything she did, she succeeded at. She was a virtuoso musician. She put together a dance ensemble in her city where she lived in the north. She was accepted to an elite intelligence unit in Saal. She was the apple of her parents' eyes. And she had the misfortune of being diagnosed with not only a brain tumor, but a rare brain tumor. And She wanted really the most aggressive forms of therapy because she was extremely hopeful by her nature. She was both optimistic and both hopeful, and we can talk later about the difference between optimism and hope, if you like. And despite the best efforts of our team, we were not successful in eradicating her tumor. She had a recurrence, and that really threw all of us for a loop because we thought we had this one, and we didn't. It's very emotional experience. So anyway, the question came up, who would really inform her of the bleakness of her prognosis and how there really was just about nothing left to do. And it was a discussion that was held between myself and her father, really outside of her room in the hospital on the seventh floor of Ichilov. And we had this conversation and we realized we were dealing with this incredibly vibrant human being, and we felt it was out of place, and I apologize for this, we felt it was out of place for us to be having this conversation, that it was literally inappropriate, because we had to be able to confront this young person. And as a physician, I thought it was me who needed to go in there and start speaking to her, and she sensed, as you're probably sensing now, the difficulty that I had. And because she was such a heroic human being, she went out of her way to allay my fears, allay my anxiety, and pretty much signaled to me that she knew why I was there. And she really helped me through it. And I do this for a living. I mean, this is what I do, day in and day out. And it's not always like this, but for some reason, this one felt really tragic to me because of just the potential that existed in this human being, and the fact that myself, the neurosurgeons, everyone who was involved in the case, we were convinced that we really eradicated this tumor, and we didn't. And just jumping to the punchline, which not everyone did here in their stories, but she died. And the experience itself became a springboard for growth for the father, who became very much involved in our organization. This is Dvorah, who walked in. We run an organization called Tishkofet, which means perspective, and which is about changing one's worldview in the context of dealing with serious illness. And
you're also married to each other.
We are also roommates and married. That's true. And one of the points I would like to develop as we go forward is that a lot of this incredible book, and please don't think this is pejorative at all, because it's not, a lot of this incredible book is sort of piecing, for me, this is my interpretation, I say this respectfully, is piecing together things b'diavad, which is very helpful and very important and really a fundamental aspect of narrative therapy. A lot of what I think we do in Tishkofet is dealing with things milchachila, because it's really not that unusual to have the phenomenon of a young person who has parents who are going to outlive them. It feels very unjust. I can speak more about that later. But it's much more common than you might think. In fact, that was one of the points that Joel Olowski wanted me to make here this evening, was that he felt it was a very important project for him to carry out, because it's so commonplace that you don't have to ask much. You find out that so many people have such an experience. I'll just tell you, a week ago, I was doing a physical exam on somebody for one of the very curable tumors that I treat, for very early stage breast cancer, and I was trying to be very thorough, which will relate to something you said before also, David. And I was examining her skin, and I saw a scar right here, and I looked at her and I said, so I guess you have carpal tunnel syndrome, and you probably had a surgical release procedure. And she didn't answer me, and I just jotted it down. And then at the end, after I counseled her about, you know, her cancer and the reason she'd come to see me, she said to me, I didn't have carpal tunnel syndrome. My child My first child died when I was 22 years old, and I tried to kill myself. It's a very, very common experience that we're processing tonight, and I applaud everyone came.
Okay, thank you all very much for those words. We spoke a lot, mostly by email in the last few weeks, about how we should do this, because there's a lot to talk about, and we do want to open it up for questions at the end. So I'm going to start with some specific questions related to the specific essays, but I want to, these are general questions that apply to everybody here, and I'd like to ask anyone else who wants to answer these questions to jump in afterwards. So, Dasi, I'd like to start with you, if that's okay. And I want to quote something that you wrote in your essay. And this is just a direct quote. So where does that bring us? Back to that healthy place where we can afford to get angry over pretty petty things. Thank God, to being normal, or at least trying to be, to appreciating life and trying to live each day to the fullest, to living the moment mindfully. So my question to you is, and I'm gonna challenge you a little bit, and I don't like to do this in this kind of setting, but I'm gonna do it anyway, just because I think it'll be helpful. Can you tell us more specifically how you do appreciate life and attempt to live each day to the fullest? Because a lot of people say that, and people who haven't necessarily gone through this experience. So it's a very sort of general statement, and I'm wondering if you could tell us more specifically, you know, how you've been able to do that. And anyone else who wants to jump in afterwards.
So that, just for people who haven't read the book, is in the end of my essay. And it's really, I think, something that I come to after a process of, and I'm not gonna, you can read the book, so I'm not gonna say everything that I say in the essay, but I think that it's not, when you read the quote, it sounds very pat, like you said, it sounds like something that people say. But for me, I think that really, going through a process of losing a child, and also the way that we lost our child, like, she was a perfectly healthy, beautiful, happy, smiley, bright, verbal, 2-year-old. She was only two. Obviously, it's not the same thing as losing a 22-year-old. But there was no reason that day that I wouldn't think that I would be raising her, you know, until she left my house to do whatever she was gonna do, go to college, or if we lived in Israel, go to the army, or shiru me, or whatever, get married, have children, etc. She was healthy. And it's a very, very complicated process. And the essay that I wrote, which I wrote, you know, 3 years ago, because it's reflections on Eliana's 11th birthday, and we're coming up on her 14th now, is really relevant and describes the process, which was a very complex process, a process with many ups and downs, with a lot of life lessons, with learning how to cope with different ways of dealing with grief, and at different stages, different things happen. What I would say is that in the immediate aftermath of Eliana's death, I really felt like a broken person, and I also felt like I could never be upset about anything, something so colossal had happened to me that it was the only thing that I would ever really be able to think about or encounter. And it was so, it was such an incredible experience that how could I ever get upset about something silly like carpool politics? You know, I mean, I'm talking like a young mother, I don't have carpool politics anymore, really, because I live in Yeshiva, there are no carpools, because it's all where everybody has to go. But let's say then, carpool politics was a big thing. So, and for me at least, when I say that in the essay, it's because I knew that I was going to be okay when I was able to get upset about carpool politics. And to me, living life to the fullest means being really normal, and getting angry at your children or your spouse and then making up, and having arguments with your friends, and just celebrating that life is regular. And obviously, we're not the same people that we were, and that's one of the things that I talk about in my essay, that one of the things that Dan and I had to really learn early on, just a few months after Eliana died, when everyone in our family thought that I was falling apart because I cried a lot, and said, Dusty, you need to go see someone, you need to go see someone, even though I think it was pretty normal. And I went to go see someone who said to me, well, what do you, and also to Dan, well, what do you expect? There's no, this is the new normal. Like, there's no back to normal, it's before and after, and things have to be in a new place now. And I think that that was true. And at least for me, that's what it means, living life to the fullest. Like, appreciating those silly politics about the human interactions we have and getting into an argument with your neighbor or, you know, yelling at your kid because you think that what they're wearing to, you know, that bar mitzvah is what you should really wear to a soccer game or whatever, you know? So, but what I do want to say also is that I do find that despite the fact that this happened 14 years ago, part of living life to the fullest is also coping with a lot of challenges that come up. And many of the challenges, like this event that happened to us, and it's true, we do react to it in a bidiyavad way, and especially an event like ours, which had no forewarning, there was no way to prepare for it. But this event reverberates across the years, partially because we had a four-year-old who I think, if she would write an essay, her experience would be very similar to yours, David. I mean, Dan looked at me while you were talking, because I think that at that age, the experience is quite different, and she did witness her sister die. And so she's an amazing kid, but we had to also help her through her journey, and her journey was complex. And I have to also say that other life events that happen also can bring up earlier traumas. So for example, after I wrote this essay, let's say around the time of Eliana's 11th yahrzeit, which was really after I wrote this essay, I had a medical event that was not life-threatening, thank God, because it was caught quickly enough, and I had surgery. And after the surgery, when the doctor said, Hadassah Hakola Barba Shalom, when I woke up in the recovery room, but he also described that things had evolved during the surgery in a way that was much more complex than they anticipated from what they saw before I came in. And I had a post-traumatic experience after that. And nobody expected that because I was very healthy and I wrote this essay. You could see how healthy I was, right? And I was arguing about carpool politics or whatever. But I really did have a post-traumatic experience with many, many symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, including nightmares. All the nightmares had my children blowing up in airplanes and drowning and things like that. And not being able to sleep and losing a lot of weight because I couldn't eat and things like that. And part of living life to the fullest is also being able to identify an event like that and say, wait a second. For me, it was obvious. I knew that it was post-trauma, partially because I'm a psychologist, but partially also because when you're having those kind of dreams every single night, it's got to be post-trauma. So, and I knew that even though I had sought help in the past, I had to seek help again. And I was able to. And I was able to, use my own internal resources and get help from professionals and outsiders, and thank God, really experience that journey as well. And I have to say, it was so unexpected. Like, at that point, I remember in the Shiva, I said, I need 10 years to pass, so I'll know we'll all be okay. I said it 100 million times during the Shiva. And when 10 years passed, and we made, like, you know, a yahrzeit evening, and I gave a speech, and I said this would be, like, the time when it would be Eliana's bat mitzvah, and I really thought that we were kind of through it, and but we weren't. And I don't know how things will unfold over the years, but I do know that we have the strength and the tools to cope with it. And I also know that the treatment that I did for when I had that post-traumatic experience, had I done it earlier, possibly could have prevented the post-traumatic experience. Because as you said, David, there's so much inside that we don't know is there until it comes out. And sometimes you can really, like in a more of a l'chafila way, even in a post kind of event, you can access it and you can treat it. And I feel like for me at least, that's like the most important thing that I would want to impart. And writing the essay, it's like Ronit said, like empowering others, I have learned, I'm very bad at asking for help. I'm very bad at delegating. That's something that I really, really had to learn how to do. And something that I continue to learn how to do. But when people have an experience like this, then that's, if you learn how to ask for help and you learn how to say, this helps me, this doesn't help me, then you really can heal. And so for me, like that's what it means.
Anyone else want to respond to that question?
She did a great job.
I'll just add a little piece of nuance. You use two words that I think are extremely important. One is almost cliche in a modern society, and that's empowerment. We speak a lot about empowering ourselves, empowering others. But right before that, you used a word which we don't pay a lot of attention to. Use it in the verb form, I use it in the noun form sometimes. You talk about imparting, to impart. Impartment is a very important part of the experiences that we're all discussing, because you have so much. And the question is whether you would like to, on that level, share. You don't have to do that. But when you choose to do that, it's just a tremendous gift. And we see that a lot in terms of the clientele that we work with. And most people are very thankful to be able to impart, because they realize they have so much inside of them. And I'm not trying to justify, you know, the why of any of these experiences, and I'm sure we'll get into the whole salivation issue of Godal versus the odd at some point during this evening. But I think that idea of being able to impart, being able to give, is just grand.
No, I will say one thing. I will say one thing. I was thinking, what I wanted to say is that living life to the fullest for me, what I picked up on is that I didn't have the experience of having a baby for any minutes. And one of the things my husband and I grappled with that first night, well, I mean, there was some quote we found from the Talmud saying that a baby in its first minute to its parents is like a bridegroom already. Like, you're already picturing the wedding when you're pregnant. And one thing that I took from that experience was that, you know, my whole pregnancy, I couldn't wait to meet this baby. And then I never got to meet this baby. And I knew enough to know that probably when I had that baby, I was going to be looking forward to when that baby was 2, and then when that baby was 5, and then 13, and then married. And one of the things that this whole process taught me about living life to the fullest is just appreciating every stage for what it is, which we all know, but we just forget. And even tonight, I have to remind myself, because I have a 2-year-old, and I'm looking forward to him being past the 2-year-old thing. But one thing I changed is that I always found out the genders of my babies, partially because I lived in Australia and my parents needed to know what to schlep, but also because I felt that, you know, I'm not going to wait till the baby's born to bond with the baby, because with that baby, all I had was a pregnancy. That was, you know, the pokes that you feel when you're pregnant, that was meant everything to me, because that's all I had. So I felt like even that pregnancy was going to be something that I embraced and I enjoyed and lived that to the fullest and enjoyed that to the fullest. And then my baby came along, even though I was longing to be past the teething stage and get to the next stage, I tried to remember to just enjoy each child, because at the end of the day, please God, I should all live to 120, but you never know. And being a Rebbetzin, unfortunately, I encountered many parents, not many, but other parents who lost children at multiple stages. And they all also learned you have to just enjoy your children and all the people in your life for the moment when you have it. That's me as living as the fullest.
I just want to repeat, and we've talked a lot about this, but there's a, like Jeff said at the beginning, all these stories could, you know, fill many books, and we do have a lot to discuss, so we're going to try and be brief. But Yonit, I'd like to turn to something that you wrote. While I was, you know, moved by all the essays, like Ben said, in many ways I was particularly moved by yours, and you know, you use this line, you know, in order to get around it, you have to go through it, or something along those lines. And that is really, and everyone else can feel free to reflect upon this as well, that is really the work, I think, that many of us have had to go through. And like you said in the essay, those that do the hard work, you know, benefit much of the time from it, and those that don't, unfortunately, do not. And that is very, very difficult work. And I'm just wondering if you could comment on how you were able to do that, and how you think you may be able to, you know, help other people confront these issues in order to get through it.
Okay, so I'm not a psychologist, and I don't know all the studies on this, but what I found was from just evidence like Ben was saying, that this happened so much and so many people came forward and told me their stories, and a pattern emerged very quickly that people who had embraced their situation, were open and dealt with it, had healed, and those who hadn't didn't heal. And it didn't matter. Some people healed from really, really terrible experiences, and some people hadn't healed from minor experiences. My grandmother's friend, who was in her 90s, called me that she still, to that day, regretted that she had had a stillborn and she had never given that baby a name. Could she give him a name because that would make her feel better? It was so many years ago. And so seeing that pattern, the truth is I had already chosen to be very open about my experience. We were very lucky, and one of the first people that came to see us in the hospital was Rabbi Rosenblatt from the Riverdale Jewish Center. And he told us basically we have two choices. We can, you know, shove everything under the rug, pretend it never happened, the Chaver Kadisha would come, take the baby, and we never have to think about it again, or we can be part of the process. And I just thought it didn't sound very Jewish, like it sounded very Christian to me to like see a body that wasn't alive. But so we originally didn't want to do that, but he encouraged us to hold our baby and to give the baby a name and to really be involved in every way we can. And that was a turning point for us. Originally, like I said, I just wanted to pretend it never happened. The hospital had offered us a memory box and we had said no originally, and afterwards we decided to take it and we were involved in every single way. And I actually remember making myself cry every day because I recognize I'm not a crier, and if I sound like I'm doing that now, it's because I have a cold. But I remember feeling like cathartic after you cry, and I remember realizing like these are necessary emotions. I think like Dasi was saying, it's a process, and that this is what it's like, and you have to go through that. And if you don't go through that, then it just stays within you. So I remember like taking time every day to really think about it and letting the tears come. And that was the healthiest thing I could have done. And I really think I had an amazing healing, and I attribute it totally to that. And on the other hand, unfortunately, I still know women that have not healed because they chose to do the opposite.
I just want to make one quick comment on that. And I was trying to leave through and find it, but somebody quoted, I know a person that's taught and inspired many of us, and that's Rabbi Dr. Israel Levitz. And he speaks about this metaphor of, was that your essay? Oh, were you going to say that? No, I'm sorry, you say it.
It's great. No, you said it. It's great. I didn't remember where it was.
We also got a lot of reading all the essays. I want to start out with something which will sound like it is contradicting what Mimi just said, and then explain myself much more clearly. We have an office right over there, and I have a young married Hasidic man who I work with and work through many issues, issues in marriage and otherwise, but he has a lot of difficulty with communication. I've at assorted times practiced with him a little bit how we could communicate, and he's looked at me and said, I don't talk like a psychologist. My psychology Rebbe, David Belkovitz, Dr. David Belkovitz, likes to quote a Gemara in the Masechta Yoma and a couple other places, which quotes a pasuk, Da'aga b'lev ish. There's two versions, two interpretations. Rabbi Yonah Ravasi, one says, read it, Yisichena, Yisichena la'achirim, when a person has worry in their heart, communicate it to others. And the other says, Yashena, read it, Yashena, Yashena midato, distract yourself away from it. Dr. Pogovitz likes to quote the research, this is putting myself out of business, that not everybody needs to discuss every single issue that ever happened to them in their life in order to be healthy. Distracting actually helps people sometimes. All the wives can pat their husbands on the shoulder. I had the following experience. The continuation of my story went like this. I was looking at Dasi during Shiva and terrified because, and not just Shiva, I remember actually we also had a healing trip to Israel. We were scheduled to be in camp in America that summer, and decided that we need to get away. We came to Israel for the summer. And I have an image in my head, and Dasty has a much more graphic image kind of memory than I do. I don't have that many images that stick that deeply, but I have an image of being in a conversation with Dasty, and Dasty looking like a deer in the headlights, and this is a month after Eliana had died, and just looking at her and wondering, is anything ever going to return to normal? Dasty was looking at me and scratching her head and getting nervous because I was all stoic and non-reactive, non-responsive, and what's wrong with Dan? One of the biggest things that I think I learned, and we in the process, is the extent to which people react in different ways and have to find their own way. Dasty coined a phrase, we were talking about your essay unit and about the only way around it is through it, and said, yeah, it's true, but there are many, many different ways to get through it. And for me, I have recollection of sitting, I described that during the ride home I was totally crying, screaming, bargaining, davening. Then before I got to the hospital, it just shut off, and that was it. I didn't cry the entire Shiva. I remember one time sitting with people from the community was incredible in the five towns, but sitting with people whom I barely knew, who were looking at me and crying and telling me about how terrible this must be, and I was kind of looking at them, not crying in the slightest, and feeling a little bit awkward. I didn't know if it was a problem. We met after Leanna died. We went and had a conversation with Dr. Polkovitz. We also, when we were here, met with Dr. Levitz, who had recently come and set up the Institute, Family Institute in the Bay. And he coined a phrase, or shared a phrase, that that I should look, because it's there. Because it's there. I wasn't feeling it, but it's there, somewhere. And he said, you'll find your pool of tears. And for me, it wasn't about crying regularly, or even pushing myself. I think that might have not been good for me, if I had taken in that I had to do something or had to cry. But a fellow graduate student in my program, whom I was not really connected with, sent me a tape with a song from a person named Curtis Chapman. I later found out that he's a very popular Christian singer, but there was nothing particularly Christian about the song. It was religious, but it wasn't Christian. And there was a song, and I was listening to this tape that she sent me, Days of Tapes, and this song just, there was a line in the song, this wasn't the way that things were supposed to be, and it just hit me. And that summer, I went a few times to the Keter in Eretz Chaim in Beit Shemesh, and it was a little strange to do, but I would sit, it was hot summer, hot Beit Shemesh, I would sit under a little tree about 10 meters from the Keter with my Walkman and listen to the song and cry. And so I certainly experienced and fully agree that the only way is through it, but it took me time to figure out for myself kind of what that way through was.
The hour's getting late, so and I'd like to really have some time for people to ask some questions. I'm going to ask, put two questions that I've been thinking about a lot and to try and combine them into one, and you'll say what you have to say, and then we'll open it up. And I agree with Ben that it is important to talk about the whole Soloveitchik, Rabbi Soloveitchik issue of fate and destiny. Many of us quoted that, and myself included, and the part of it is in the book. However, there is a lot of literature on that, and you know, maybe we could save that for another time unless somebody wants to comment on it. It is very important. So my two questions are, somebody said this, I think it was you, Dasi, you said you wanted to comment on it, and maybe this will be helpful for many of the people who are here. But I think we've all dealt with, as a rabbi, I could write a book on the dumb things that people say to people who are sitting Shiva. You know, you commented on that, Dasi, and I'm just wondering, you know, perhaps give some examples. There are even a lot of rabbis who say a lot of silly things. I'm not Rabbi Rosenblatt, not Rebbetzin, not Weiss, but maybe we could comment on that a little bit. And I want to tie that to, you know, we didn't get to discuss yet some of, Ben mentioned Tishkofet, Devorah, and Ben and I have been doing a lot of work with Barkai in terms of teaching the rabbis the whole skills of chaplaincy and spiritual care, which is a growing and field in Israel, much of it due to Devorah and Ben and to Tishkofet. How can we, you know, you said you're a Rebbetzin, Dan, you have smicha. You know, we all have relationships with rabbis. Ben perhaps could add some of it from the professional view, even though he's not a rabbi. How can we train our rabbis and our professionals to be more sensitive and to really know, you know, what they should say and how they should react? So after that, we could open it up, and then I have some carpool politics that I need to discuss with some of the people.
Okay, so yeah, stupid things people say should be heard like lies. Yeah, so a lot of people did say things, but what, it's never intentional.
Well-intentioned people.
Or just by accident. For example, like one of the first nights that Sarah Sade Chuva when this happened. So we had a lot of time came, and we were with my family, and there was that popular commercial at the time, it's 10 o'clock, do you know where your children are? And it was 10 o'clock at night, my mother kind of started, it's 10 o'clock, do you? And then she looked at us and she just went, ooh, maybe I shouldn't say that. And at the same time, my grandmother looked at me, she was already much older, probably in her early 90s, and she looked at my stomach and she said, you have all that and you have nothing to show for it? And she went, can I say that out loud? My point is that even the people that cared for me most said the things that hurt the most, and that wasn't intentional. The way my husband and I described those first weeks and the things people said to us and how we felt, it's kind of like if you have a sunburn. Nobody knows you have a sunburn, and someone might want to just pat you on the back, and it kills. But they have no idea that you have a sunburn. So people could say the most innocuous things, and it's very painful, but it's not anything about them. It's because of what you're going through at the time. What that taught us, oh, and there's one other thing, is that one other rabbi did come, and very well-meaning, told us this whole Kabbalistic thing, that this baby was a gilgul, and, you know, he had lost a child himself, and someone had told him this, and it was very comforting, and he had built it up, and I come tell you this amazing answer, and you're going to feel better about everything. And when he told us this whole gilgul thing, my husband and I, we just looked at each other and said, I don't get it, so I was a taxi cab, like, you know, it just didn't do it for us. And what I've learned afterwards, and this is where the practical part comes in, is that when people go through difficult times, there's no explanation. And there's no explanation needed. That's the truth. Nobody's ready to hear answers. What people need is just presence. You know, I have a brother who's terrible with emotions and words, but he sat in my hospital room and just wouldn't leave. And that did more for me than any of the words people would say. And that's what my husband and I have learned and taken with us when we were serving as rabbi and Rebbetzin, is just being there. I had a sister-in-law who just, she didn't write to me for a few days, and then she wrote me an email saying, I don't know what to say, so I keep writing things and I just erase them, but I just want you to know that I love you and I'm thinking of you. And I wrote back to her, that's the perfect thing to say, and that's the only thing to say. And that's what everybody, I think, can take with them, is that if you know somebody that goes through any difficulty, like this or any other, it's just being with a person and knowing that you're there for them and that you love them. There are no words that can take away the pain, but also there are no words that are needed.
I think that what David said about writing books, so everyone who sits Shiva, whether it's for a child or for any other loved one, even an elderly loved one, can probably write a book. And I want to just, I want to add to what Yonit said. First of all, I think it usually is not intentional. Some people really are not so intelligent, but that's like a totally separate issue. We don't have to give real, I don't think giving examples is necessary. Like most people can imagine what kinds of things people say. But what I would say is that, like one thing that I have, Dan and I have both noted, we've talked about this many times, is that often when people say inappropriate things, either it's because they're very nervous and they don't know what to say, sometimes it's because something that they find comforting and they're just sure that that everybody will is just not comforting to either most people, or it is comforting to some people, but just since everybody's different, it's not comforting to the person who they're talking to. But I have also found that often people talk to themselves, meaning especially when something really scary and tragic happens that's unexpected, people are scared and they feel really vulnerable. So some of the really not helpful things that people say are things that either the person will find reassuring to themselves in terms of like, well, this couldn't happen to me because, right? So like, because I would like, let's say, never feed my child grapes, right? Or because, you know, I would never let my child play there, or, you know, the equivalent of kind of telling someone, well, you know, you were walking on that street, so like, of course you got mugged, and the person is saying, but I wouldn't do that, so. So I find that that's really something that often happens, that people are talking to themselves, and they really don't realize. And I think that that's something that is really important to think about. Like, before you try to say something that you think will be comforting, think, is this for me, or is this for the person that I'm trying to comfort? And the other thing that I think is really, really helpful is that I think that presence is very important, and it is very helpful. But you can say almost anything as long as you put a disclaimer ahead of it. Like, if you say, this is something that I found comforting, I know that not everybody feels the same way about things, then it comes from a place of, I'm trying to comfort you, this is something that might help, but I'm not forcing it on you and saying, you have to find this comforting, or this is the answer. And I think that usually when it comes in that way, meaning not being sure that you're gonna give the person the answer is the thing that makes it really much easier to accept almost anything that anyone would say, because it kind of takes away that element of the person talking to themselves. So.
Okay. You started asking us about how we could interest rabbis in doing this kind of work, and I believe one of the draws for a lot of the coursework that we offer is people assume that we're going to give them that magic bullet, and I agree with you, it's really not out there. Very quickly, there's some research that was done by a group at the University of Haifa. And they actually went into Shiva homes sometime after people had gotten up. And they asked them, what were the things statistically that were most comforting to you? And what was amazing to me was the most frequent answer was when people said, and this is usually not about our situation with very young kids being deceased, but people who had you know, longer lives, the most frequent answer they got was when people would say really good things about the deceased person, even if they were made up, which it sounds preposterous, but actually shows us how tenuous this whole experience is of trying to comfort someone. And that's the operative word, and we've used it so many times in the last 3 minutes answering your question. But I would argue that it becomes very hard to comfort another person until before you are comfortable in your own skin. And that's a lot of the work that we end up doing with you and through Tishkofe. And the last point I want to make is I was thinking about this in the build-up to tonight's program, since for me, you know, the pusher was Joel, and he's a mathematician, and I took calculus with him. So I don't know how many lovers of math there are here, but when you take calculus, the first thing you learn about is the derivative and the integral, and they're kind of opposites of each other. And I was thinking that to find comfort, what we often do is ask people to draw upon their own experiences. And the concept that I was thinking about, the thing I want to write about, is the idea of integrating your experience over a lifetime. In other words, if I go back in my 5 decades and I say, what were the key moments that really brought me to feel this way about these heavy issues That does a lot if I work on processing them. And the idea of integrating that over our lifespan, each of us doing that, I think creates a comfort level that then allows us, hopefully, to comfort others.
I think I always remind Joe Wawoski that the highest grade I ever got on a calculus test was 37. So now I ended up with a B+. That's my grade. I always wonder about that. But I just want to... Oh, Jeff wants to...
I wanted to add one point to this topic, and that's the differentiation between a shiva on the loss of anyone, where we have the kind of drill that we know what to do, even if it's well-intentioned people coming and saying silly things, and other well-intentioned people coming and bringing the lasagna every night, and a team of people that are there watching the kids and things like that. We know what shiva is, we know how it works. But there's the other phenomena with neonatal death where there is no shiva. It's certainly not halakhic shiva. I mean, de facto, there's shiva because people sit at home, they don't do anything, and maybe they get the lasagna, maybe they don't get the lasagna. But because of that, people who normally would be there and would, you know, be there just saying, I don't know what to say, but I want you to know I'm thinking of you, they don't say that. And it's particularly true. I like your point, Dan, that there's only, you know, the only way through is through, but everybody has a different way of getting there. And I think this is particularly true, and it's why it was very important to me to draft the two of you to write an essay collaboratively for the book. Because not infrequently, men and women, mother and father, experience it in different ways. And sometimes that causes tensions or misunderstandings in a relationship. Often a relationship will grow stronger by going through it each in their own way. But this is particularly problematic with male friendships. That men who, if there's a shiva, know they show up for shachar, smincha, and mariv and think they've been yotzei, the obligations of being a friend and being there for someone, when you don't even have a shiva, and by nature, with a neonatal death, the mother will and should be getting more attention and support because she's also just been through this traumatic physical experience. The father sometimes overlooked, particularly by his friends, because they're doofuses and they don't know what to do or what to say, they feel uncomfortable. I know in my own experience, I had very close friends, very, very close friends, who didn't call, who didn't email, who didn't, and even though I would be in regular touch with them up until then, suddenly they fall off the face of the earth. And then 4 or 5 or 8 months later, when we reconnect, there's some kind of like awkward, you know, they have to make a kind of admission that, you know, they've been derelict because they didn't know what to do. It's important that people know what to do. And what to do is to just be there, is to just be there. Particularly in the case of the neonatal death, where you don't even have the minimum rigors of shiva.
I just want to, I'm going to end by saying two very quick things and then we'll open it up. I just want to give a plug to Devorah and Ben here. Their organization, Tishkofen, is amazing. And I had no idea that in this little house in Katamon somewhere, all this was going on. And they deal with, like Ben said, L'Chakrila, dealing with a lot of trying to, L'Chakrila, train people and do all sorts of things. And I think that they're really a resource for a lot of these issues and you should get to know them. I think I'll leave the last thing for another time. So if people want to ask questions, feel free, please. It should be a question, not a speech, and I reserve the right to reformulate anything that's asked. Right, yeah, we're recording this, so you should speak on the microphone. So does anyone like to start?
I just want to mention what you said about neonatal death. So, in short, I lost triplets when I was 24 weeks pregnant, and I delivered them, and they were alive, and I held them every day. And according to halacha, I don't know the exact age, but I think anything over 20 weeks is considered like a viable, and you have to, I mean, I don't know what circles you were in, but the circles that I was in, it was in the Hasidic community, I had two boys and a girl, and they had to have a bris, and I had to name them. And I had a very big problem with the way halacha deals with it later on. Like, you don't, there's no matzeva, there's no yahrzeit, and it's like as if like these children were born and then they just disappear off the face of the earth, and you're not allowed to talk about it. And in the Gaddish community, you know, like the hospital kept sending me every year a memorial and different things, but in halacha, you don't do anything. And I have a really big problem with it. So over the years, finally, this has happened 15 years ago, I went to Rabbi Riskin because I couldn't live with myself that here I was like hiding the fact that I had three children and like nobody knew about it. So Rabbi Riskin, Paskin, that like when I bench left for Friday night, when I light candles, there's an Indian that you're allowed to have a lot of light in a house. So he gave me a psak that I could light three more candles in a different room, but when I make the bracha, I should make a bracha on my regular candles. But I have a really big problem with the way halacha approaches neonatal death. And, you know...
Why don't we take a couple of questions and then...
Right, okay. Thank you. Right. Anyone else?
My name is Mindy Edelman. I'm an art therapist.
Just careful because it's not so.
I ran a bereavement group for women who lost children in acts of terror. Most of them were 7 years away from the process they would take. It was a very interesting group. I was very nervous to do it because, for obvious reasons. But there was one thing that stymied me. Towards the end of the year, it was a year long, and towards the end of the year, I brought an interesting project, I thought, of creating a dream board of your dreams for the future, and was met with an awful lot of resistance. And I wanted to know if you have any insights about it. I don't know if it had to do with the time of year, because it was before Pesach, and I know Chagim is a sensitive time for people who've lost a loved one, or I don't know if maybe it had to do with the nature of the group. They were together quite a few years, and maybe that was one of the things that they were a little bit stuck together. I don't want to make any assumptions. I want to know if you had any insights about that. And I just want to make a general comment that I happen to think that I do agree with what you said. I think that people who experience bereavement revisit it and reprocess it at different junctions in their life, sometimes when they least expect it. But I think that that's something that one can say to people that expect to revisit it and reprocess it at different times along the way. Thank you.
I just want to say I was very moved by what you've talked about, and I hear a lot of people talk about the limits of halacha. And I guess I want to ask you, particularly you three, since I live with him, I can ask you many times, what might be some things that you have found that you see as ritual that would resemble things that we'd want to see in halacha that you might have created that could give us some insight about, despite the limitations of halacha, how ritual might be helpful? If you could think of some examples.
Okay, so I'll speak to that. So that was addressed when I went through my loss, because it also was, you know, there was no halachic shiva, but Rabbi Avi Weiss was very, well, maybe this is kind of his forte, is to see where you can take halacha and also embrace it and augment it, and, but in a very honest way. So the first thing he said to me is, by the way, it just because it's not halacha doesn't mean you shouldn't have a shiva. He said, hold a shiva, it'll be a non-halachic shiva, like Jeff mentioned. And that's exactly what we did. Also we went and we had a formal, we went to the funeral. We had a, even though you don't have to do that, you can. And Rabbi Weiss addressed it, you know, why doesn't halacha have And by the way, he also had lost a baby.
And he has
an article in the book, that's right.
The first chapter.
And I didn't know it at the time. I found that out afterwards when they came to comfort me. I didn't know that they had also lost a baby, but it came out. So one of the first things that he had said to me was, just because it's not halacha doesn't mean that we don't care about it. This wasn't a totally satisfactory answer. I'll tell you what he said, but I know what he meant by it. He said the reason why halacha needs to tell a child say kaddish for the parent, because sometimes a child likes a parent, sometimes a child doesn't like a parent, and sometimes they're feeling attached, sometimes they're not attached, or the parents are very old, and maybe they drifted. So halacha needs to make that requirement. So that they remember, and that parent is honored. He said, but when it comes to a child, of course you're going to remember that child, and of course that you're going to be doing things on their behalf, on behalf of their soul, and so that's why halacha doesn't have to require it. Again, for me, it wasn't totally satisfactory, but the fact, I think, that he acknowledged it did make me feel better. I don't know if it was his advice, but I right away started to light that extra candle, and I light that extra candle until this day, and that for me was very important, because I felt exactly like you said. I was moving to Australia, and I wanted people to know that I had a child, and it felt very important to me as well. And I wanted my other children to know that I had this child, and so I still light that candle today. And then all my kids know because of that candle, and that was important to me. Another woman who came to visit me in the hospital, Gula Torsky, who lives in Oslo. Does she still live in?
She's not a visitor.
So she said what her family did when they lost the baby was at the Havdalah service, they would always pass the besamim around in each order. So when they got to that child, they would always hold the besamim up to acknowledge that child's place in their family. So there are things that people...
What's significant about that?
Yeah.
Lula told me that was a family custom that,
right.
That one of their other children started because the other child was aware.
It came about naturally. That's right. They were in the middle of the service, and the child decided to do that. So I don't know if that totally satisfies you. I agree that halacha doesn't have the things that we might want, but it doesn't mean that we can't have them. And certainly, on my experience, I was encouraged to do all those things that anything that I can do. And there is a little matzeva, and we could have put a larger one if we had wanted to, and it was. Completely, and we were encouraged to do all those things by rabbinical figures made me feel okay with it.
So I also want to say that I think that, so first of all, it's a little bit different because we didn't have a neonatal death, and so we had a real shiva, and it was different, so the halachic aspect was different. But I think that in this book, if you read Rabbi Weiss's article, he actually put up a matzeva 40 years after his son passed away. Like, they didn't even know where the baby was buried, and then they found him. And so what we found, I think, is that the halachot of avilut, particularly in the immediate aftermath during the shiva and shloshim, there's a really tremendous amount of flexibility in those halachot. And often, this might be my natural tendency, and my husband is much more by the book than I am, but what we really did find with the halachot avilut was that often there were choices. You know, it's okay to do it this way, it's okay to do it this way, and it's okay to do it this way, and whichever one feels right for you is the one that you should do. And that was something that I think was very, very helpful for us. I also, to this day, and we have, when Eliana passed away, we had one remaining live child, but I continue to light a candle for Eliana every Shabbat, and we've had more children since then, and I light an extra candle, meaning it's Eliana's candle. In our house also, we have pictures of Eliana around. In the beginning, it was sometimes a little bit strange. People would come to our house, and then there would be this picture of this girl who was clearly part of our family and was missing, and I sometimes felt like I needed to tell somebody who came so that they wouldn't, you know, feel stupid if they asked a question. But now it's really just, time has passed, and it's a natural part of the landscape of our household, and we have a son who's 2 years old, who is actually named after Eliana. His name is Elichai. And our kids, we have old professional pictures that were taken of the girls, Tilly and Eliana, together about a half a year before Eliana passed away, and they're hanging framed on our stair rail going up the stairs. And our kids, when they carry our baby Ellie up the stairs, he says the names of all the people, and he always says Eliana. They keep her memory alive. I think that for me, after Eliana passed away, things that, the types of rituals that I was looking for, like the focus on death and on the yahrzeit, that was very hard for me. Now it's much easier for me. Dan found his pool tears at the cemetery. I didn't go to the cemetery for 8 years. So then I went to the cemetery. Now I go to the cemetery. You know, in the last few years, two of my grandmothers passed away. They're buried near Eliana. That's very comforting to me. I sometimes even go there to talk to them. I'm not a cemetery person, so that's weird for me, but I do that. But the focus on the yahrzeit was very hard for me, and I had a very, very hard time. I always felt like we should commemorate it, but I didn't know how we should. In the beginning, Dan made a siyum at Shal Shifts and Shul, and I didn't go. Over the years, we found ways to do it in a way that, when I felt more comfortable being involved, and now we do something that's much more public. But it's because we evolved over time, each of us, and we really tried to respect each other's process. I felt that focusing on Eliana's birthday was better for me. I wanted to focus on her life, even though it was short, and to remember the just her beauty and her humor. And it also happens to be that her birthday is one day apart from her older daughter's birthday. Like, one of them was born on, our older daughter's birthday was May 8th, and Eliana's birthday was May 9th, and they were exactly 2 years apart, and that made the birthday thing also complex. And in the first few years, we always buy a helium balloon, like a big helium balloon for our kids on their birthday. And in the first few years, we bought Eliana a balloon on her birthday, and then we just released it in the yard. And, you know, and Tilly would like yell, enjoy it, Eliana. And it was, I mean, it made us cry, but it was very beautiful. And then 1 year we stopped doing that. But I feel like we needed to create our own rituals. And every family has to find the ones that work best for them. You know, and I think that at different times, different things are going to be the things that are meaningful. You know, I don't know, we moved away from where we lived, so I don't know how I would have felt about, like, let's say, the bat mitzvah circuit of the girls who were going to be Eliana's age, because we moved far away from that. But I know that that was something that worried me when this happened to us. We just weren't with those kids anymore, so it was a little easier. That's not why we moved away. But when we moved to a new place, a lot of people didn't know about Eliana. It was weird, you know? It was also a little bit of a relief, because, like, what Jeff mentioned about that, like, not having Shiva. So what also happens is that, like, you might sit Shiva, but then you could have all these strangers walking up to you in the street and saying all these strange things, or in the milk aisle. Intense questioning. How are you? What do you do? I'm buying milk, you know? Right? So we had, you know, like, we did find ways eventually to incorporate her also into our life and our new place. And, you know, those are some of the different things that come up. But I do think there's a lot of flexibility, and you can continue to ask the questions.
Okay, I think this is a good place. Mm-hmm. It's a fitting place to stop, just because of the time. And I'm sure people are here for a little while after. I just want to conclude. I put a post on Facebook today to encourage people to come, and I remember when Jeff sent me the galleys to proofread, and I read the first line of the book by Rabbi Heshy Weinreb, and its quote is, "This is a good book. I wish I had it long ago, at those times when I really needed it." And I think in many ways that really says it all. So the book, as well as other books, are on sale. We'd like to thank the OU Center, OU Press, and all the organizations that helped make this possible. Thank you very much. Cool.